Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America?
Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no rules, no network, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And look at this, for the first time in a very, very long time, no wait, or at least not a long wait between episodes, as we're back after our big season premiere last week. I'm not hearing any dishes in the background, so that's a good sign. And we have an awesome episode planned for you tonight, folks, and it's going to be an absolutely nightmare-inducing edition of the program, haunting and frightening. I shouldn't look forward to it, but I am dying to dig into this topic with our guest, who is one of my favorite guests on the program all time, and I'm not just blowing smoke up his ass. This is true, because Gian Cassar, who is our guest tonight, he's this tenacious researcher. He's just tenacious. And he's like cold-blooded, too. And he just dives into these subjects and slices and dices them with this just surgical fashion of investigation that is awesome to me, because I love his books. I read them. I'm like, oh, my God, this guy is just digging deeper and deeper into the details of these cases. And he's looked at the Bermuda Triangle. He's kind of synonymous with the Bermuda Triangle. He's like the one guy left who's carrying on the torch of the Bermuda Triangle. And he's got a new book coming out next week, which we'll talk about later, we should mention it at the beginning. So I'll find out that so people know right away, because who knows. And he's also written about Bigfoot. He had an outstanding Bigfoot book, Recasting Bigfoot, I believe, or there may be a proper title of that, but it was Recasting the Bigfoot Idea, and really looked at it in an incredibly interesting way. And then he looked at Jack the Ripper and produced another outstanding book. So it's like the Bermuda Triangle and Jack the Ripper, dude. This is, not only is he looking at classic, awesome, you know, in search of type cases, but he's giving them a modern spin, and he's looked into them deeper and deeper and deeper. And some people, you know, like I said, this Bermuda Triangle thing, it's no one's talking about it anymore, but Gian Cassar's still looking at it. So welcome back to the program, Gian, one of my favorite guests, also one of the toughest. You always seem like you're very serious. I try to make you laugh when we do the interview, but it always is hard for me. But I enjoy talking to you so, so much. So welcome back to the show. Thanks for coming back on Banal of America.
I'm sorry I have that reputation. I'm usually like to be humorous. That's all that gets me through all this. Because you have to consider all that I do. I'm looking into a lot of disaster. I'm looking into a lot of murder. There's really very few things I investigate that you can enjoy doing.
That's true.
Well, I prefer to be humorous, but how can you be humorous about someone when they're, you know, heads under their arm?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, that's kind of what I was alluding to here when the show started. You know, it was like, I'm really looking forward to talking to you tonight, but at the same time, it's like I feel guilty because this is a horrifying subject we're going to get into, but. As I said, you do some outstanding work, and, you know, what I like is that you do these different topics. It's unbelievable. Some, you know, anybody else would just rest on their laurels as the Bermuda Triangle guy, but you're back doing that again, but you've long since moved on to other things and done other topics, so I think that's just awesome, because that's kind of what we try to embrace on the show. And we'll pivot right – well, first of all, quickly, give me the new – the new Bermuda Triangle book. give me a shout out for that here at the beginning, so folks, because you know sometimes people they drop off the episode later, so I want to make sure they know that there's a new Bermuda Triangle book from you coming out next week, right?
It is, yes. It's my sequel in the trilogy. I cleverly named it the Bermuda Triangle 2.
Oh, nice.
And it's an odyssey of unexplained experiences at sea. It should be out next week, and it'll be available online or in any bookstore that still exists, if there are any out there. So you can order it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and whoever carries it online. It'll be in hardcover and paperback.
Nice.
280 pages and a lot of new cases, new expanding on theories. And it's a subject matter I really have trouble getting through anymore because I'm so done with it after years. 27 years now I've been investigating.
Wow.
All these Kolchakian things. I think it was the reporter you put on to me once that called me the real-life Kolchak. And that kind of stuck. I like being called that because it kind of explains that I will investigate anything that's, you know, worthy. It has some kind of truth behind it. You can tell, and you can solve it. You have a chance of solving it. I'm not after just, you know, enjoying some chill and thrill that can go nowhere. I mean, what's the point?
That's what I like about you, man. You're trying to solve these things. You hit the nail on the head right there, because it's like, not only is he investigating things with surgical precision, but he's trying to actually solve it. He's not just navel-gazing at the mystery and going, isn't this interesting? It's like, yeah, it's interesting, but he's trying to get to the bottom of it, and I have huge respect for that. So
what's the journey? That's what makes it enjoyable, a quest. You mean you're going somewhere. Just spinning a theory, just spinning mystery, you're not going anywhere. That's for campfire stories at night. But I like to really go somewhere and try and come to the end of the journey and have solved it at least sufficiently to my abilities and then be able to convey it to my audience. So with true crime, it's different. What we're going to talk about tonight, it's a whole different thing. You have to have a thesis ready to independently deliver to the appropriate jurisdiction if you want to do this seriously, which is what I'm doing. And in this case, we're going to talk about someone that I'm not even going to write a book about, but I did it online. It was to be a very complex online presentation on my Questerfile site that would have video and that would have all these pictures and text and of the police cases. And it almost destroyed me for years doing this because it's 50 cases of rape and 12 murders. And it's not just that, it's the way this guy went about doing it. His calculated stalking, I called him the real-life Michael Myers, and I think that's what really clicked with people finally. And the FBI, of course, over a year ago already had that national press conference to reawaken the case, and then their 48 Hours recently did a big show on it. Mm-hmm. And I think Paula Zahn is going to be doing one soon again with one of the guests calling up tonight.
Yes, yes,
and
we're going to make
it. So this is the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker.
Right.
Call the Night Predator.
Let me set you up, though, Gian, so you look professional. You know, I've been doing this a long time. People are going to think they're going to be like, geez, dude, this guy still sucks at this. So talk about, this is the new thing. This is what we're going to be discussing tonight. We're going to take a crazy journey, folks, and it's going to be terrifying. I was just chilled to the bone last fall when Gian turned me on to this stuff. To start, to get meta, you know, how did you, because you're kind of from that area. I don't know California geography well, but I know you're relatively in that area. So you're from California.
Right now, yeah, I could go to all the crime scenes.
Yeah. How did you get
Sacramento area.
How did you decide to go after this case?
I was winding down my Zodiac killer investigation. I was stifled at trying to get handwriting on my prime suspect. And I came across a self-published book by Lieutenant Larry Crompton called Sudden Terror. I had gotten into, in 2010, I had really gotten into true crime. I was bored with all the Kolchakian type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had wondered, you know, whatever happened to that guy as a kid? I remember him vaguely in the hood and all that, and he was threatening to kill kids with a sniper rifle. So I really got heavily into the Zodiac after doing Jack the Ripper. Anybody does cold case, they have to start with Jack the Ripper.
Right, right.
That is the ultimate cold case. And so I published that book. I was writing Horoscope, which is my book on the Zodiac, and I needed to change, I needed to clear my mind, and I came across Lieutenant Larry Crompton's book, Sudden Terror. It was about a case he worked on called the Hysteria Rapist, or known as EAR, which is not a very good handle, but that's what they gave him.
Right, right.
Also known as the original Night Stalker down south when he turned murderer. And he was one of the Contra Costa County sheriffs, and he had saved all the OG logs, the officer-generated report. So he had all the details. He changed the names of the people involved, and he fictionalized. It was a bit of a fictionalized account with made-up detectives based on real-life people.
Right,
right. All the dialogue in that book spoken by the villain back and forth from the victims was maintained authentic. And so it was reliable to that extent, and he was mentioning street names where these occurred.
Mm.
And so I could finally winnow this down. I was so fascinated that there was this guy who was really the real-life Michael Myers. He stalked at night. Nothing stopped him. He militarily sized up a house in a neighborhood, found out when the victim was going to be alone, and he would get in the house and terrorize it. He was a sexual terrorist. He did not just rape them, but he terrorized, he ransacked the house, he would tie them up, he would put plates on their back so he would hear them, you know, crash if they moved while he was going about the house, eating their food, doing whatever, and or he would come by sometimes, quietly pad by them when they were on the floor tied up, and he would snip scissors by their ear just to terrify them, and in between this he was raping them. And so he was not just a rapist, this was not just a guy waylaying women on a jogging path or something. This was someone who militarily sized up a neighborhood, several victims, and then winnowed it down to one particular victim and struck and did this repeatedly at night or early morning until he sent Sacramento into a panic. They couldn't stop him. He expanded from there. They gave him the title East Area Rapist because he struck in the East Area of Sacramento in the suburbs there, Rancho Cordova, Carmichael, Citrus Heights. And he expanded over Northern California to Modesto, to Stockton, to the college town of Davis, to the Contra Costa area, Concord, down to San Jose, for a three-year period, starting summer of 1976. And then he vanished in Northern California in the summer of 79 and appeared in October, I believe it was, 1979, in the Goleta, Santa Barbara area. And no one was sure if that was really him down there, because now he started turning murderer and he was killing couples. And he sized them up in the same way. Somehow he found out who they were, when they were going to be there together, and he went in and did his thing, killing with an instrument that was always on the property already. So he brought nothing there that he would leave or leave clues, and he took nothing with him that would that he could be traced with on the road.
Right.
That's encapsulating what basically was a 10-year crime scene, most of it was done 76 to 81. He was gone 5 years, he came back, and he killed his final victim just a few days ago, 1986, May 5, 1986.
Ah.
And her sister will be calling up tonight.
Yes, yes, Michelle Cruz is going to be calling in tonight.
The last one, yeah.
The sister
and
of...
And he struck very close to where he had killed his last victim in Irvine, California. So he stuck to his pattern, and he was successful. There was never a prime suspect for this guy. Never. Although he left enough clues. Of course, there was DNA. But there were a number of composites of someone looking, you know, stalking or prowling in the neighborhood or just casually driving by. But no one could really be sure who it was, because he always had a ski mask on or some kind of homemade mask, always wore gloves, had a gun or knife or an ice pick, and surprised his victims while they were asleep in bed, shining a flashlight in their eyes, hissing in their ears through clenched teeth, growling through clenched teeth. So he was disguising his voice as well. And he succeeded. There's never been a prime suspect, and he's the number one serial predator in history. I was glad to hear 48 Hours say that. Some like to say he's just the number one serial predator in California history. But from my calculation, he is the number one, period. And I put that on my website repeatedly in the articles and in the introduction. And Michelle Cruz, who will be calling up tonight, told me she gave it to CBS, who did the show. She gave my website, and I know they were going through it frequently. So
nice.
I'm glad they picked that up and really accentuated this real-life Michael Myers.
Right. So you're saying the most
stop.
Prolific serial predator
offender
in American history.
Yeah. 50 rape victims that we know of, at least 12 murders, but that still is only reflecting a fraction of the stalking and prowling he did to winnow down his list.
Right, exactly. This was like, right, exactly. This was, like you said earlier, it wasn't like some guy just grabbing a lady out for a jog or something. This guy was,
he was
tenacious.
Meditative and calculating.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's why you're the writer. You got the words.
I say that to accentuate just how evil this guy really was. This was his hobby. He obsessed on it, and he perfected it. And no jurisdiction in California could catch him. They tried to anticipate him a couple of times, pretty wisely, too, in the Concord area, I know, where sheriffs even staked out a couple of potential homes because this guy would get in the home sometimes days or a week in advance. He would hide the ligatures with which he was going to bind them under sofa cushions or so forth. He would bind their, blindfold them with torn towels, gag them that way. And he would put this in the house first sometimes. So he just have to come to the house with his weapons and wake them up. And a couple of occasions, homeowners realized there was something wrong. They looked under their cushions and found them, and they called the sheriffs. And the sheriffs quietly staked out the house and were there one night with their guns ready, heard the dogs barking coming closer, but he never returned. This happened at least three times that I can remember, how somehow he got wind that his next victims had been identified and he wouldn't come back. So either he monitored a police scanner and realized calls were being made to those from those homes about an intruder, or I don't know how. He had so many ways trying to determine schedules.
What's the profile on this guy? Like, how old do we think he is? What's how they break it down like that? What's his, how big is he? Is he a little scrawny guy or is he a fat guy? I know. Well, there's one to ask.
Guy.
Okay. Well, how old do we think he is?
I think he was a bit younger than what they estimated. They estimated late teens to early mid 20s, most likely. From the way he talked, his earliest victims had mentioned that he was about 5'9", 5'10" in shoes, a thin figure, not a gym one, but an athletic one. So maybe like a swimmer's body. He was lean, but he was not a muscle builder.
What I thought was interesting in the book, too, as you said, it's an online compilation, and actually, you should buy a URL and just direct people to that specific page, because I have it here. Where is it? It's the Questor files. Yeah, that's true. They just Google it, I bet. But it's the Questor files, and then you got to look around a little bit, and you'll find the East Area
True
Rapist.
Crime, yeah.
I'll post the link in the chat room. But the one thing that stood out, first of all, your entire collection there, or your work there, is absolutely unbelievable. And folks listening to this, if you want to get more information, you got to go to John's page because as I was telling somebody the other day, you visited like all these places, right? You visited all these neighborhoods, and there's like Google pictures and pictures from John, like essentially like showing you the point of view of this guy and what he was like looking at as far as how he could get out of the area and how the neighborhood was sort of set up. It's really, really interesting stuff and creepy as hell in a way, because it's like, oh my God, you're in this dude's footsteps. It's like, ooh, Jesus,
That was my point. It was to stalk the ultimate stalker. I had to find out how he did it. There are very few witnesses anymore, but the neighborhoods are witnesses, I felt, to how he did this. He carefully assessed everything, and I began to uncover his stalking method and how he used parks, which was known back then, canal trails. I discovered that he used those power pylon corridors and communities that were attached to another community by those little walkways, between fences, between homes.
Yeah.
And schools were across the way. He was very logistic in his assessment of topography.
Right.
That's why he was so successful.
Right. And now all the stuff from the fall that when I read the work is coming back to me. I should be writing these things down. But one thing I found really interesting from your analysis is, and I hate to laugh, but it's like, this guy had a different mask almost for every crime. It's like, who has that many masks? It's insane.
Yeah.
Like, we're
some homemade and some that were not. They've got a picture. The FBI website has a picture of a couple of them that he had lost where he had put them, and they recovered them in a bag in a sack as he was stalking one place. So he had a couple of extras handy just in case. But he had apparently almost always he wore a different ski mask, which is a clue, of course, how he could be getting all these ski masks, because considering how many times he struck is only a small portion of how much he was stalking.
Yeah, it's like try and go get 50 ski masks, folks.
Yeah.
Different ones tomorrow.
Some were homemade. Some were made from tarp or from a pillowcase maybe, or cheesecloth was one description. So when he was jogging in the morning in Walnut Creek, I believe his mask was described by the victims as a cheesecloth because he came in jogger's attire. So I assume he was jogging out there looking normally so no one would suspect him. And so he had to have something very thin hidden under his shirt or in his jogging shorts, and it was cheesecloth or a pillowcase fit. So he'd get to the house. He would look innocent enough, I guess, get in the backyard, put the pillowcase over his head with the eye holes in it, and produce a kitchen knife from the drawer or an ice pick that he brought with him, and he did his thing.
And it's believed, we'll continue from that thought. It's believed that he would go to these houses by bicycle and park like further away. Is that kind of the idea?
Sometimes, yeah.
A number of times in the book you kind of, say that there's a bicycle involved here. The car, like he parks farther away and then he gets in by the bike so he can get away faster or something like that through these trails.
Yes, I think he parked strategically while he was stalking, and then on the night of the attack as well, he would hop fences and have parked on the street behind where he struck. So, you know, no one would associate a car pulling up on the street where he struck.
Mm.
Or he would park a bike down the street and maybe walk quietly through the yards. Well, his footprints would be found in neighbors' yards and so forth. Well, he was that meticulous. He would call. These neighborhoods were vexed by hang-up phone calls, so he was not only calling the victim in advance and then hanging up, determining their routine, if they were home and when they were home. He would be calling neighbors to know when they were around. And I guess he developed a very complex understanding of when he could simply walk along and not be seen, because he knew when people were and were not home, and he would then move through yards, and that's how he remained so much a phantom.
Yeah.
I say no one knows his face. We know him only by his mask, just like Michael Myers. This is a cold-hearted shadow that materialized over people's beds with a hissing clenched teeth and a ski mask and a flashlight and gun in their face.
Oh.
So we know him physically, tangibly, only from I think a size 9 shoe print is what he wore, a size 9 shoe or size 9.5. And that's basically it. And then there's some questionable composites about if this was him or was not seen walking in the neighborhood or driving prior. But physically, there's DNA, and only proof of his existence physically is that shoe print in people's yards and the horror he left, you know, behind him, and scratches on a screen.
So yes.
He would scratch victims, potential victims' screens where they were open in the lower left side. And I guess he was assessing the acoustics in the house or seeing if a dog would come. That's how careful he was.
That's how creepy he was, man. I remember reading that on the thing, and I ended up looking at my screens for like the next few days.
Boy,
I hope people aren't doing that to me.
I know guys who read Crompton's book, Sudden Terror, who live, you know, 3,000 miles away. And after they finished it, and these are big guys, and after they finished it, they told me they went around and closed their windows and doors, whether they were in New Jersey or New York or wherever. And we're talking 40 years ago in California. That's how this a detailed description of this guy's method, unrelenting method, really freaked people out.
It's really scary because it's not because the whole idea that he's been in the house already, too, is even creepier. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. He committed double jeopardy, double, triple jeopardy. He was in neighbors' homes, the victim's homes prior. Then he would come back again. People would find pictures askew or missing and knew someone was in their house, or a drawer that they knew had been closed, was only half closed when they came back. And so they knew knew someone had been there. Now that really, you know, unnerves people. And then the phone calls would commence. And then he even called some of his victims later, a year or two after the fact, and said he's going to kill him.
Right, right.
That video, one of those audios is preserved online, and people can hear what apparently is his voice threatening to kill victim number one. He called her again in January 1978, January 2, 1978, and he raped her on June 18, 1976. So this is what she had to deal with, and her and other victims had to deal with. Not knowing if this guy was going to come back, terror was his big thing. Rape was only one faction of it. Terror, they were deeply in fear of their lives, and that's what they wanted the police to know, and that's those victims who have spoken out wanted the audience to know, that rape was really, how bad rape is, it was not the worst thing. It was not what was on their mind. They were sure they were going to die, and he stayed in their homes for hours terrorizing them.
Yeah. It's creepy. I just locked my door. That's how creepy. That's how creepy it is. Oh my God! And the scary part is, folks, that really, this guy's still out there. We presume. Like we don't. I mean, we're going to keep talking about the case, but that's the. I mean, like we're talking about it because it happened a long time ago. But he got away with it, folks. This sicko is out there. That's why you got to lock the door. That's why you locked the door.
People think this is so far because it's 40 years ago, and it's culture shock to think of 1976 and 1977 again and all that. But if he was as young, if he was his late teens and early 20s, he's just pushing 60 now. So he could, if he kept up his figure, if he's still alive, he could very much be with us. Remember, he spanned out his crime spree over 10 years. So he was last known to be around in 1986. And so 30 years he's been silent, and but that doesn't mean he's not there.
Well, part of me wonders. I'd be interested because I don't know if it – well, I sure – but maybe by now they would know. But it's like when the crimes stop in the early 80s there with Michelle's sister, does – like the thing is they didn't know he was connected to the two sprees, you know, until much later, right?
Yeah, a few suspected it at the time because of the original M.O. when he first struck in Goleta. It was just his usual M.O. He didn't kill the victims. They actually got away from him. And then the next victims, a couple months later, he did kill. He shot them. And then he started changing his M.O. He would bludgeon the other ones, and it was basically imitating the bedroom basher who was afoot at that time. So there was some confusion whether this was the same guy. There were some detectives who suspected it. So he was given the handle Night Stalker by the sheriff's department.
That's why he has two names.
It didn't take with the press because this guy spread his crimes out over from Irvine, which is South LA area, to Santa Barbara, which is far in the north. And so he never caught on with the press. He was not a very distinct serial killer in the LA area, despite having 10 victims ultimately. And so it never caught on, and Richard Ramirez was then given the handle the Night Stalker. And the law enforcement really wouldn't recognize that because they had given it to this guy already. So eventually they had to call him Original Night Stalker just to separate him from Ramirez. But this guy really earned the handle Night Stalker.
He has a very Spinal Tap-esque name where he has to... It's very part of the thing, and I think I read this on your stuff. I think they said it on 48 Hours. It's like part of the problem with tackling this case in a way is the name problem. You know, it's like it doesn't roll off the tongue. You don't really have a good. I don't mean you. I mean like anyone. You know what I'm saying? It's like no one really.
I've said it many times. EARONS. That's an acronym. Original East Area Rapist.
I kind of like that the best, but now, you know. But when you're talking about it with people who look at it, you know, they just call it EARONS, right? Is that kind of?
Yeah. So I called him the Night Predator, hoping that would catch on because that's close to Night Stalker, but it really reveals he's the Night Predator. It does with some people. Some people call him
Night Stalker.
Some call him the Golden State Killer, which I will not because it's giving the nickname of this state to a killer like he's an official product of the state, and I don't think that's pretty good. And some call him the Diamond Knot Killer, which I think is a little too...
Specific.
It's not very popular, but it sounds a little too crime noir. But no one knows where, you know, he, that's one reason why he never really got as famous as he should be, but so that people would have, you know, tried to out him a lot sooner than now, is that he has a very unwieldy handle. It's not like the Zodiac or Jack the Ripper or something catchy that people are going to wish to inquire about. The closest I've come to really getting people's attention with a handle is by calling him, you know, the real-life Michael Myers, because then right away they can crystallize that in their mind.
Yeah, that's true.
What we're talking about.
That's true. I think we got off on a sidetrack there, but that's cool, because I was wondering, Saup's in 81, given that they didn't even connect the two in California, is it possible this guy just moved across the country and kept doing what he was doing?
There are those who have tried to stalk a trail, and I've looked into some things too, and it could be, I mean, he was gone for 5 years. Where was he from, you know, late 81 to 85, 86, when he returned and struck only a mile from his last Irvine victim's house? So he didn't, it's not like he was around the L.A. area learning even incidentally new neighborhoods. It's like he really was gone from L.A. and didn't know it very well. And wanted to strike again, so he picked a neighborhood that he knew from years ago. So where had he been? Well, I don't think L.A., and I don't know where he could have been for 5 years. And, you know, people speculate jail or the military, but so far no trail has uncovered him. And I happen to know, I talked to one of the detectives, and he said every 6 months they put his DNA through CODIS, which is the federal system, to see if it makes a hit. And this guy was never arrested for a felony that required DNA be taken.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So he's just vanished.
So he was that careful.
And we really have no, aside from the DNA is all we have in a sense, you know.
Legally, yes, that could pinpoint the guy now. 40 years later, it would be DNA.
How do you even know? Because you have a suspect in this thing, right? You say you get into
this. I do, yes. I have a group of them with one prime suspect in auto wrecking. And so my pathway to that is matching a handwriting. We actually have his handwriting from one of his botch-up. Ostensibly, it's his handwriting.
This is from the sheet of paper that was like the school assignment?
Yes, that in Danville, when he botched up one of his attacks and fled, the dog, the bloodhound, was able to trace to where he had parked. And there were these papers there that presumably were his. There's a map on one side that looks like he was working a neighborhood, and he even blotted out the second house from the corner, which was the house he usually struck. He had a pattern, and it was usually a corner house or house right next to it. And so it seems that these are legitimate and that it would presumably be his handwriting on this other school assignment. So if I can match that to one of my suspects, I guess I would have enough for a thesis then to recommend, in my case, for the main one, it would have to be an exhumation. If it's one of the other guys that's involved, that's within my list, they're alive, and that's why I don't even speak of it, because I don't need to alert anybody. I don't speak of them at all.
All right. So you have multiple suspects, is what you're saying. Not necessarily
yes,
that they were working together. Or were they?
They all fit. They're not working together,
okay.
But they fit what I would deem would be the critical clues. This guy, you know, he was always seen in a jalopy, or someone, I should say, was seen stalking a neighborhood in a jalopy before.
Yeah, the villain, as we call him.
Yes, the miscreant. And it was always, when the license plates were traced, they went nowhere, they were deregistered, or they went to a wrecked car that was last known to be in a wrecking yard in Lodi, or even as far as Windsor, California, which is up from the Bay Area. So this guy drove around pretty much, and I started tracking auto wreckers. And someone who would be in a position in a family auto wrecking business, that he would be driving clunkers. Because some of these guys dealt in used cars as well. You know, they picked some of these cars apart, or they were selling used cars on another lot. They were all interrelated. And so that's what led me to my group and my main POI, is that they were very much a part of the auto wrecking business and could have been driving around Northern California making parts deliveries or picking up parts from these wrecking yards and pinching a license plate when they wanted. And then this guy would put it on the car he was driving, and he was completely safe. If the license plate was taken down, as it was on occasion, it would be tracked to the wrecking yard where the car had been taken in.
Jeez, didn't they do any further investigation than that? Should they?
Well, apparently, you know, I would assume they looked into auto records. I mean, who else could be doing this over Northern California? It's not like it was one occasion. I happen to know it went to one place in Lodi, one place in Windsor. There was another location. So it's over Northern California this guy was driving. Assume in work. And he was striking then during this time in Modesto and Stockton and Davis and going back and forth, and that's quite a distance going back and forth from Davis to Modesto.
Yeah.
Modesto is about an hour or more south of Sacramento, and Davis is to the west of Sacramento.
Now talk about the voice, because it's creepy as sin, and what I like about you is rather than just say, oh, it's creepy, like you have sort of an idea of why he has this creepy voice. And so I don't want to be a spoiler, so tell us
this
about
guy this guy was so logistic that there has to be a reason why he always disguised his voice. And it would be that would be a way he could be identified by his victims. They couldn't see his face. They couldn't see anything. He never took his gloves off. So what's one way they could identify this guy? Well, he might have had a very distinctive voice. And some of them thought he was lowering his voice, that he had a higher pitched voice or something about it. And this guy calling up the "gonna kill you" call, which you can play. I suppose it is on YouTube.
Yeah, we'll play it on the. We'll play it at some point. I'll stick it in. Oh, I guess I could do it while we're on the phone. Yeah, but go on. I'll look it up while we're on the phone.
In any case, if you hear his voice, he is trying to make it. It does sound like a young voice, and it sounds very nasally. It sounds like he's stuffed up to me. Pretty bad, but it sounds young, and it sounds a little effeminate. And she's saying he's going to kill him, and he's calling him the B word, and this is lower down hissing, and this is, if this is the right guy, and it does seem it is him, this is what the victims heard right up in their ear when they were blindfolded, with scissors snipping by them, or he was running the knife along their throat and along their thigh, or an ice pick that he threatened to stick through their head, or a gun right up to their face, and then he'd rape them, then wander around the house and ransack it. And so you get an idea of what the victims heard in the early morning hours when they were disturbed.
Should I play it? It's really creepy.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, I'll play it. Hopefully, I'll put my phone up to it, folks, so you can hear it up to my speaker. All right, this is how high-tech we are on the show, Gian, so hold on a second. So enjoy your nightmares tonight, folks. Gian, what did we just do to these people? That's horrifying.
Yeah, he would be doing that for hours with them. And doesn't it sound like a young voice to you?
I don't know what it sounds like. I've listened to it several times, to be honest with you, before we before we did the show. It sounds like someone trying to. Yeah, I get kind of what you're saying. Yeah.
He's disguising his voice anyway, but it does seem like an awfully young voice to me, with a bit of, bit of that nasally stuffed up.
Yeah, I hear it, yeah. Yeah.
And so maybe that's why he was hiding his voice, because if he was made to speak to the victims or they heard it, he might have had something so distinct they could pick him off by that.
Mm.
While, he's got them, unless he just enjoys terror, which he obviously did, but I think he was a little more practical than that. I think he had to disguise his voice because he had a unique way of speaking.
Mm. Well, it's certainly frightening. And that was the call we talked about earlier to the first victim, right?
Yes, that was on January 2. The Voices in the Background is actually a TV movie that was on at that time. I started digging into it, and it inspired a couple of guys on the message boards who had really tried to crack what those sounds were in the back. I was trying to figure out what the sounds were, and they got involved again. And they just, I guess, pulled everything that was on TV that night January 2, 1978.
And watched,
they watched all these movies, and it is, in fact, Breaking Away, I believe, with Lee Remick. And you hear Lee Remick talking with her daughter in the background. No one was sure if that was in the background of his phone call or the victim's house or what. No one was sure if those were real people speaking in the background, and he was trying to, be quiet. And so finally it was found out by these two people on the message board that it was Breaking Away, which did air on January 2, 1978. And I assume the sheriffs knew that, or they would have, they just didn't mention it when they released it. And so a lot of independent researchers had to go to a great length just to find that out. There was a Concord detective, retired detective, who actually was playing this repeatedly in the Institute for the Blind. And they were listening to it because, of course, their hearing is much better, their perception. And they were trying to figure out who those people were in the background and what it was. So unfortunately, you know, some of the stuff that has been released was not qualified enough. If not only do you have web sleuths out there trying to figure out what's going on, but you have, you know, retired and active duty detectives
right,
going to the Institute of the Blind and having them listen to this tape.
That's a novel approach. I don't know if that did it work? Did it help? Do we know?
No, it's, in my knowledge, those two on the message boards are the ones who finally cracked it. I was trying to figure out what the words, I got some of the dialogue right and posted it on my blog, and was trying to speculate what it could be, if it was live people or if it was television. And so that's when they really got involved again. And I guess they just went through every movie that was
released,
every TV show, everything, and they were listening and finally picked out the exact inflections and were able to determine, I think it's about 28 minutes into the movie.
Spooky. It's all spooky, man. It really is. And I do want to know. I hope he's listening tonight, because one thing that I that I noticed in the voluminous recaps that you produced of these various crimes, each and every one has its own page, folks, and it just gets more and more terrifying. Is that the victims repeatedly mention that he has a tiny penis? So. Right?
Yes. Apparently, yes, it was like a roll of dimes at the best of time. A couple have said that it was like a dollar bill, the length of a dollar bill, which is a very different thing.
Yeah.
And so there's some confusion whether, you know, there was more than one guy involved, but how he could have been imitating him so perfectly. Maybe it was, maybe he was doing something different. I don't know how you can disguise the offending organ.
Who knows?
And he was never always aroused. It was a part of his terror shtick. He actually raped, I think as low as young an age as 12, 13 years old. So there were virgins as well. And they were still afterward. That's how small he was.
Oh, God. Jeez. Well, there you go.
So who knows how that was involved.
Yeah.
In inspiring him, but certainly he mentally got into this. Just like it's his hobby, it was his great love. He devoted every waking hour, you would think, to doing this. When people read the pages on this, they'll see how many times someone has reported stalking in the neighborhood before the fact.
Sometimes what do you
mean? Well, some guy chased someone out of his neighbor's yard once.
They never picked up on the fact that that was probably the guy at the time.
Yeah. He would stalk a neighborhood weeks in advance, select his victims, come back, nail one, wait a couple of weeks, and come back again. That way he was only there in the neighborhood for a certain period of time instead of being seen over a period of weeks. So he might come back to a neighborhood two or three times, but really have only stalked it, you know, months before, so that there was no real warning he was coming back. He assessed victim number one there, two, three, an echelon, and then struck his first victim, waited weeks or months, came back to the second one. And so he had a very careful stalking pattern done where he would not overstalk a neighborhood and therefore be identified.
Yeah, and he bounced around a lot, so it was kind of...
Yeah, so he stalked many neighborhoods. While he was striking in one neighborhood, well, he might have been stalking another one that very day, but then struck in an older one that he had stalked already.
Mm. And then, like, the layers of creepiness to this guy are unbelievable, because one of the key cases, or one of the most interesting tales associated with this, is the how he – there was like a community meeting about this guy, and then some dude, a husband, stood up and said that he was – you know, this guy was a clown because he won't come and try it at a house where there's a couple. And then the next time it happened, it was a house that it was a couple, and it was that couple. So that's the
something like that. Yeah, he was,
is that how it
works?
Did I mess up?
It was the Del Deo. I think it was the Del Deo school community meeting, and he got up and chewed out the police first for not being able to stop this guy. And the first couple strike was just before tax time in April '77, and this was victim number 23. So no, he had already struck couples by that time.
Ah, okay.
He struck couples by victims 16 and 17. It was the paper that had said he had never struck couples before.
Ah, see, fake news.
I don't think that inspired him. I think he was just working his way up.
It's all
but
right.
Yes, with the Del Deo school meeting, one of the persons, as I recall, that made a big stink there was later victim 21 in Sandbar Circle.
Yeah.
His wife was, I should say. He was... I don't know if he was tied up or if he didn't even know what was going on.
Well, the other thing that's really creepy is, like, if you're claustrophobic, this part's, like, really kind of gave me the shivers, where he would make the husband lie down and he would put dishes on his back. So if he got up and knocked the dishes over, then the villain, the miscreant, would know that the jig was up and he needed to, you know, act fast.
He would rush back to the bedroom. He would threaten to blow the guy's brains out if he did it again. Or he never fled, but he would go back on a couple of occasions when he heard them rattle and fall off. He said, "I'll kill your wife if you do it again." And so he restacked them on there, growled in his ear, and then, you know, go blam, 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 with, you know, speaking to him in his ear. And then he'd go back out and continue to terrorize the house. And, you know, the husband couldn't help but move. He was tied so tightly with his wrists that his hands were purple. That's how tightly this guy tied them up. And you're going to start moving, and he has these bowls and saucers piled high on the back. Well, it's going to rattle, and of course it did, and some fell sometimes. And he would rush back down the hallway, or he would pad back very quietly. And the husband would know he was there, and suddenly he would jolt him, scare him, and everything would rattle. And the guy says these, you know, "Fall, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to blow your brains out, or I'm going to, you know, go cut her throat," or something like that. Imagine going through that for hours while your hands are turning purple and you're tied up like a hog.
Yeah, yeah, we can't stress enough. These things weren't just like in-and-out deals. I mean, we talked about it earlier, but these were hours-long ordeals for these people.
Yeah, this was. I think the mayor of Davis is the one that said, "This guy's not a rapist, he's a sexual terrorist, and he's very clever." And that's how he operated. And in my opinion, he even got in good with some of the victims' dogs. A few of them had big dogs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they never caused a problem with him. I think he was feeding them in advance. And victim 21 was one of those cases where I think he was feeding the dog in advance. There was one victim that had a young pit bull that was on the bed with him. And that pit bull was pretty ferocious, but it barely gave even a growl with him, and he picked it up and threw it in another bedroom and closed the door. Dogs would be yipping at his heels as he was approaching the house in one case, and he wouldn't stop. He'd just approach, he got in the window, and...
Now, talk about...
That's why I said this guy was not stoppable. It was like, the movie Halloween, you throw him off a balcony and look down, and he's no longer there.
Right. Well, that's a good segue, actually, because I want to talk about times that he did get away, because that's probably the closest we have to anyone, who can. I guess all the victims actually can provide information. So, but maybe when botched jobs are usually when you get the best info. So, what kind of incidents do we know of where, you know, he couldn't follow through on the deal?
There's a few where he botched by being opportunistic. One was victim 4. She didn't even live at home with her parents anymore. She was 29, divorced, I think, but her washing machine was on the blink, so she came by one night while they were gone on vacation. She was doing her laundry, and so there's no way he could have known that she was going to be there, and the home was on a canal. So he must have been working the canal. He must have been waiting for another victim, or he was scouting the neighborhood, and he saw her, liked her, and he was opportunistic, and she turned around in the driveway while getting ready to load up and go back home around 11:30 at night, and he just decked her, broke her nose, drug her in the house, and did all sorts of terrible things. That's a clue that how he would be opportunistic. Clearly, she could not have been an intended victim.
Right.
And so he was stalking the area of Del Campo Park at that time. The big botch up that he did was victim 48, his last in Northern California. He disappeared after this. This was in Danville in the Bay Area, East Bay Area. The couple woke up. This was in the second floor of a townhome, which was very unusual for him. He did that only a few times. He struck first floor homes, usually. Second floor of a townhome. The guy sits up and actually sees him standing by the high boy, slipping the mask over his head. And the famous composite of the EAR with the mask on comes from this guy. And the guy said, "Who the hell are you?" Started cussing him out, shouting at him, got his wife up, kept shouting at him while he made her run down the stairs. And EAR just froze there and looked at him, didn't reach for a weapon, didn't lower his arms, just held his mask, you know, over his head. And the guy finally ran downstairs and got out, and EAR boogied himself and got across the park, got down by Sycamore or something, wherever he had parked, across the park. And that's where he must have opened the door like a flash, sucked out the paperwork he had there, and he got out of there. And that's one of his big mistakes. And he must have felt it was very significant because he never struck in Northern California again. And this guy described the windbreaker he was wearing, and it had some kind of name stenciled there on in script writing on the left side. This was a blue windbreaker, button, not zipper, button-down collar, and some kind of stenciled writing that could have been Coors or Corn. One detective speculated Coach. I'm not sure. It could have been a name. It could have been a brand. He liked Coors beer, but you would think. And Corn goes nowhere. I've tried to track any business that could have been called Corn. I thought maybe Cobra, because Cobra was, you know, it's big CB era. And Cobra was involved in that. And, of course, auto wrecking or racing or whatever would have a lot of Citizen Band radio attached with it. So I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, EAR must have thought it was significant. He got out of Northern California, and that's when he went down to Santa Barbara so he could upload himself when he wanted. And a few months later, he's already stalking Goleta, and of course he strikes a home that's on a canal. He sticks to his old pattern again. And then his second victims there were very close by yet again. And he starts killing. He enjoys it. I think his first murder victims were unintentional. The victim, Dr. Offerman, had gotten the bindings loose from the appearance. The bindings were only on one wrist. And he'd been shot in the chest and in the back. So he got shot in the chest, whirled around, was still shot while he was going down, was found on his knees. His girlfriend then shoved her jewelry, I guess, behind the bed. She thought they were being robbed. So she probably shoved it behind the bed first. And he went over there and just shot her in the back of the head, execution style. And then he got out of there because he let off with, you know, gunshots.
Right, right.
And after that is when he killed them quietly. He bludgeoned all of his next victims. So it's after that that he consistently murders, whether they're couples or individuals alone. And they were all bludgeoned. So I think he got a taste for it with his first, you know, unintentional murder. Because everything indicates that he shot because he had to. And then quickly dispatched her. He didn't hang around. And then he enjoyed it so much that he carefully refined himself, and now he waited months and months between each attack. That's how careful he was now, because he knew he was committing the ultimate crime. So it would be months. The first murder was in December of 79. The last would be in summer, or was it fall, of 81. And then he was gone for 5 years and came back and followed the exact process with his final victim in 1986.
Right, right. We're going to bring Michelle.
He enjoyed it. He enjoyed killing. It was the new thrill. And he knew it was the ultimate crime, and he took his time now, months apart, not striking a few times a month like he was before.
Mm.
It was now months and months apart, sometimes 6 months apart.
Well, it's interesting, though, in a sense, too, that we see that he botched the one, the last one in his original area.
And, yes, in East Bay.
Yeah, and then he journeys down to Southern California.
And botches his first one there.
Exactly.
He got away.
That's what's sort of interesting me here. You know what I mean? It's like, and then
botches his next one, basically, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't think he intended to kill him.
Right. No, I agree with you. Yeah.
So he's got three botches back-to-back, so he's unfulfilled now.
Do we know if the people in Queen Anne Lane in Goleta, wait, no, that's not the one I want. Do we know if the first murder victims, do we know if they, if it came because they were trying to escape?
Well, she was still in bed, so I think he, the doctor, challenged him. He got loose at one point and bolted up from the bed to get him and got shot in the chest and then crouched down and rolled around to his knees and got shot again in the back.
Ah, okay. So, yeah. So, essentially,
she was still in the bed. She was shot in the back of the head laying face down on the bed.
Right.
So, I don't think there was, like, both of them tried to reach up and challenge him. I think
No, I know what you
mean. Doctor sprung up and tried to get him, and it happened really quick.
Right, right. It's
another one tried to do that too, and just got bludgeoned. I think 24 times. It was overkill.
Well, this guy's twisted, man. He's twisted. Should we bring Michelle in? Because I'm gonna message Michelle. We're gonna bring. Let me just see here.
I mean, he was so calculating in how he stalked the house, but when he was challenged, at least in these cases, he went into a rage and he really just greased him. And yet that guy in. When he was taken by surprise by this big guy shouting at him in Danville, he just stood there statuesque and looked at him.
Yeah. It's very, the whole thing is horrifying. And we're going to go into a whole, we're going to stay on this, but sort of take it to a different level in a way, folks, because in a moment, Michelle Cruz is going to be calling in. She's the sister of the final known victim of Eron's. I kind of like Eron's, to tell you the truth. But you may disagree, but I feel like Eron's at least kind of rolls off the tongue. But her sister, Janelle Cruz, was killed by Eron's on May 4th, 1986. So as Gian said, we're almost on the anniversary here. And here is Michelle Cruz. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me over here. Hey, Gian.
How are you?
Good.
It's good to talk to you. I was saying to Gian, I hope you've been enjoying the show so far. Actually, hopefully we're doing justice to this crazy case.
You are doing justice. A lot of details. That's good.
Yeah. Well, I the devil is in the details, as Gian mentions on his page on the site. And as I was saying to him when we started, it's like, I was looking forward to the conversation, but I felt terrible because this is, you know, such an awful, horrifying, as Gian aptly describes him, this is a villain.
Yes, definitely not a fun topic.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. So how you've sort of become, you know, you're speaking out here. I mean, you're on the show and everything. So, I mean, how did you get involved in this? You know, obviously with what happened to your sister, but I mean more recently, how did you get involved in this new upsurge of people trying to look for justice? And I mean, John, you can kind of help her out too if you want. I guess we can talk sort of now about how there is this growing interest and movement to get to the bottom of this. So, I mean, Michelle, you had no answers like for all these years, and when did it kind of come to you that this was connected to this Eron's thing too? I mean, I'm interested in that. So I guess talk to us, Michelle.
Well, I think probably I started getting a little bit into the case around 2009. I mean, it took me about 20 years. I was kind of, I wasn't into the case for about 20 years. I just kind of went into hiding. I didn't talk about it. Our family didn't talk about it. It was just a non-subject.
Right.
Anytime we did talk about it, it was just a big argument. So just left it alone. But then in 2009, someone invited me to, you know, talk on the boards, and so I started there. But then, you know, that didn't really do anything. I would say probably last year around March, I just kind of had this epiphany, you know, it's like, all right, I really need to do something because nothing's going on. You know, it's almost well, it is 30 years and still no answers. And so I started my YouTube channel and I started going on the pro boards and just talking to as many people as I could and my sister's Facebook page. And then when I did that, I started getting a lot of people coming to me, reaching out with different POIs. So I started researching their POIs, and then from that, working with my detective that I work with, and just advocating, really starting to advocate for the case and reaching out to a lot of media outlets, and it just kind of went from there. So basically, I would say it probably started last year, 2016, with the YouTube channel, and then, you know, media outlets and the FBI doing their press conference and things like that.
Right, right. Yeah, it's become a massive, massive case in the last year or so. And I imagine a lot of that is thanks to you because you put a face to this thing, you know, in a lot of ways. So,
yeah, I mean, I think I started it, and then Debbie Domingo kind of, you know, she took hold of it as well. So her and I kind of went on it, and then now Jane Carson Sandler is kind of doing her thing. And now there's a rape victim that's coming out, Margaret, and so different people are starting to finally come out of hiding, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. Now, I assume, like, when all this went down in 86, like, I'm sure, like, you guys were, your family, you know, you were in contact with the police and stuff. At one point, did it just sort of, like, drop off where they were like, we can't do this?
Gosh.
You know what I mean? I've never met anyone who was ever in that position, so it's interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, the initial interviews with us with the police department back in 1986, I can remember being interviewed one time, and it probably lasted maybe about an hour, and it was with a couple detectives, and that was literally right after Janelle was killed. You know, they brought me into a room and interviewed me, and down at the police department, I guess, the Irvine Police Department. And then my parents, they were in Cancun, and when they finally got home, they were interviewed. But honestly, I never talked to them, my parents, about their interview, and they never asked me about my interview. And then after that, we moved away. We got out of our house. We never went back to our home, and we moved back east, and we never talked about it again. I mean, it was literally just cut off. Police department, and they just never reached out to us. We didn't, you know, I think I reached out to them once or twice a year for the next 20 years, but that was it. I mean, you know, it was really strange.
Now, how old were you when this happened?
I was 17. Janelle was 18. We were a year and 5 days apart. So I was 17. I was a senior in high school at the time, and I was. Mm-hmm.
Well, where were you that night? Because I assume, because this happened at your house. So what happened? Like, I'm interested in sort of the details of like where people were that night. Like, did you ever notice anyone had been hanging around the neighborhood or anything?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I had been gone for about a month, maybe two months, because Janelle and I were really close. We did everything together, had the same friends, but it was a ski season, snow skiing. So me and some of my friends took off to Mammoth and got a job up there. And it was during my last year of high school. And yeah, it was probably not the best thing to do because I left high school to go work in the mountains. And, but maybe it was a good thing that I did because that's, you know, when Janelle was killed. And I was actually in a snowstorm when I got the call. So you know, one of my girlfriends, she called me and told me my sister had been murdered. I thought she said married, and I was like, what? She said, no, murdered. And it just took a minute to process. I don't think I even said a word after that. And it took me about a day or two to get home just because of the snowstorm. We were stuck, you know, and loads. It was probably one of the worst snowstorms up there, and we were stranded. So I think it was 2 days before I was able to leave, before the snow melted. And I got home, and my parents still weren't there, and probably took them another day or two before they got there. They were in Cancun, Mexico, when they got the call. So that's what we were doing. You know, I was up skiing in the mountains.
Jeez. That just shows, John, the opportunistic nature of this guy, because he probably kind of knew that you took off in a sense, and that your parents took off too at the same, you know, the window
right.
was there. This guy struck.
Well, my parents.
He'd been stalking for a while, probably.
He could have been, and you know, I talked to my sister on Friday. She was killed Sunday night, early Monday morning. So it was the third I talked to her, Friday the third. And, you know, the last thing that she said to me was, I love you. And, I said, I love you. And she was just in a really good time in her life. She had a new job. And she didn't say anything about feeling like she was being stalked or watched. But that was Friday night. My parents actually left for Cancun probably Saturday morning, Friday or Saturday morning.
See.
And
yeah.
She was killed the next day. Saturday night, they heard noises. And Sunday night, she heard noises before she was killed. So those two last days, she did hear noises.
Yeah, so that's his
but
MO right
that,
there.
I don't know. Right.
Yeah.
So my parents were only gone for a day or two, and I had been gone for 2 months.
Right, right. Whew. Now, do you say people said you must get a lot of these. You say POIs, that's how much you get them, I guess, because I was going to step in, but I'll explain that. That's person of interest, folks, person of interest.
Right.
So you get a lot of these from people. You must be inundated right now.
Oh, gosh, I get so many. I can't work on all of
them. What are you supposed
them,
to do with them? Yeah, like what do you?
Well, a lot of people don't know what to do with their POIs. They're just full, you know, and they say, this guy's really strange, and so... You know, I'll help them research their guy and, you know, we'll do some background on him and find out the locations of where he lived and if he was in the military and where he worked. You know, in 76, where did he live and, you know, kind of see where the pattern is, you know, down from 76 to where he was up north to 86 and, you know, in the Irvine area. Just kind of see where he worked or if he was in the military. You can kind of tell. I mean, if he was out of the country, automatically it's not going to be him. But, you know,
right,
you can kind of, you know, research the person and help them out a little bit. If the person seems to be really good and his locations kind of match up and his age and maybe his size and just the different things, then, you know, and if he's a really good POI, then I'll forward him over to the detective that I work with, and then she does, you know, more, you know, deeper investigation
right.
on the person.
Who's
she
with,
if
the
she
FBI
can
or the...
him. She's with Orange County DA. So, yeah, I work with her. I've been working with her for about 3 years now. But right now I'm working on two. One's up north in the Sacramento area, and one is actually in Irvine. From Irvine and the one POIs, from Sacramento. Yeah, I'm working on two right now. I just can't do a whole lot more than that because, you know, I do work and I have my family. And I'll help people out as much as I can.
Now, at the risk of causing a radio fight here, what's your thoughts on Gian's POI?
You know, his POI sounds good too. You know, there's so many POIs that they seem like they really match with the serial rapist, Golden State Killer. There's a lot of things, you know, the eye color, the size, the location, you know, so his POI is good, you know, and my two kind of seem pretty good too. You just don't know until you get the DNA.
That's the thing. I'm glad you brought that up, actually. If you ever get the chance to advocate for another issue, I came up with this idea. Gian, you can maybe explain if I'm crazy or not. But there should be a law that when somebody dies, they just take the person's DNA just to solve cold cases and to help people get out of jail. Like, there's no – it's an innocent – there's no one really is a victim in this proposed
law. Someone
starts
talking right away about their rights. You know, no one.
You don't have
no
any rights after you die. That should be the deal. You
know? Your family members, maybe they fight for that, supposedly.
I suppose,
but there should
be.
I agree with you.
I think that would be the ultimate solution to so many of these mysteries and vexing cases.
I don't know why people would get upset, really.
I'm sure lots
of everybody has to
get
their fingerprints for something.
Exactly. And it's
we
like you're dead.
Yeah.
You're not going to get So that way if someone's like, oh, you're going to frame me or something, it's, no, dude, we get your DNA after you die. So, you know, it's like you're judged by the science afterwards, man. So you're, so that's
and
my.
Actually, that's a good one. And then Proposition 69 that went through in, you know, California, I would love for that to go through in all the different states. That's a hard one, though. But I would love
that?
For, that's where they get the DNA from the people, from the felons, from prisons now, you know?
Yes.
That was what Bruce Harrington was able to put through, is the Proposition 69. That's what he fought for. You know,
right,
his brother was, you know, Keith Harrington, who was killed, and his wife, Patrice. So that would be another one where they go state to state.
Yeah.
And put a lot
that's my idea
like
for... I teased it on Facebook, like, back in the fall that I came up with an idea that could solve, like, every cold case. Because, you know, I saw this, like, thing on JonBenet Ramsey, and at the end they're like, we'll know when the DNA comes through. And it was like, you don't know that. You don't know if you're ever going to get it. So if there was some assurance, you know, I think that would be an interesting idea. So.
Well, that, and then there's the familial DNA, too. So that's good, too. You know, if he does die and he gets buried and we don't know, maybe one of his family members will slip up.
Yeah. I mean, you wonder if somebody like, how somebody could keep that a secret. I mean, there are people that lead double lives, I know, but it's like at the same time, it's really...
You wonder if someone doesn't get suspicious in the family.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who spends that much time on this, it's like, I think somebody would notice. But,
and all those I don't know how much those composites were broadcast at the time, but they do show someone who consistently shows someone who has a longer face and a pointed jaw. Those that are the most reliable. So you would think that someone, but again, I don't know if how broadcast at the time all these composites were. Some of them might just have been shown to victims, you know, been in the police blotter, but not a couple of pretty bad ones got in the newspaper. I know that, but that was about it.
Now, Michelle, when Janelle was killed, did you guys realize at the time, because there was that 5-year gap, did you realize that she was a victim of the original Night Stalker, or did you just think it was a random thing?
Yeah, just a random thing. You know, when they took me into the police department and they questioned me, it was basically, you know, who was Janelle hanging out with? Who were her friends? You know, you give her names of people that she was hanging out with. I never expected it to be a serial killer. I figured it was probably someone she knew, a friend, you know, that we were hanging out with, our age, you know, someone that was mad at her, a boyfriend. You know, the guy that she was with was looked into for a long time, but he was cleared through DNA. There was another guy, a friend of hers, you know, a guy friend that was cleared through DNA, but they were the guys we hung out with, people we knew.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until years later that, you know, when they did the press conference, the Orange County Sheriff Department did a press conference in, when was it, Gian? 2001, I guess it was, 2001? I think where they linked all the Sacramento or up north cases to the Southern California cases. That's when I first found out. And, you know, someone asked me, well, how did that feel that, you know, they linked all those, you know, 50 rapes and murders. Honestly, I don't even remember how I felt because I was still focused on just Janelle, you know.
Right.
It's just a strange, weird thing to process, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can't even, you know, as we were getting to bring you on the show, I was thinking to myself, like, I'm not even sure what to ask, but I still have a million questions.
Right. Well, you can ask anything. It's been 30 years. I mean, I have been asked pretty much everything. And
did they tell you ahead of time when they were going to have this big press conference, or was this like you read it in the paper?
No, they did, actually. I remember kind of a strange thing because I started that YouTube channel in March. And then little things were happening here and there. People were finally seeing who I was because nobody had seen who I was, you know. And so then people were talking a little bit more about my YouTube channel. And then all of a sudden, you know, my detective that I work with, she did give me kind of a warning. There's going to be some press conference. They're going to, the FBI is going to put it out there, and they're going to put a whole bunch of media attention to the case. And it's going to be June. When was it? June 11th, I think it was. Gosh.
Did she tell you that they had figured out that it was linked, or was she like, it's secret information, it's going to come out?
No, this was 2016. This was last year. The linking was 2001.
Oh, okay.
Which one were you talking about?
Yeah.
I originally meant when they realized it was all connected. Did they let you know, or did you just find out in the newspaper?
We got to spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?